You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. This week, Spycast would like to thank the podcast Hackable from McAfee for their support. You'll hear more about this later, but first, let's meet our guest.
So we are joined today again by Greg Elder, the Chief Historian for the Defense Intelligence Agency. This is part two of Spycast's regular conversations with DIA. Again, how frequently we're still figuring out, but you'll hear from Greg and eventually others from DIA discussing their key role in providing intelligence for decision makers at the Pentagon, on the battlefield, and in Washington. You can check out our first conversation from June 13th of this year, the same place you're listening to this podcast. So welcome back, Greg. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here again at Spycast.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
So we spoke the last time about DIA's role in missions and events that occurred during the Cold War, but we essentially circled around the Soviets, kind of really focused on the periphery. So today, let's center much of our conversation on the Soviet Union. And I'd like to tackle this topic more thematically versus chronologically, and kind of pick up big themes and take some chunks out of it. Really starting with nuclear doctrine. I almost pulled a George W. there, nuclear doctrine. Because I think that is kind of the foundation of this Cold War standoff between the U.S. and the Soviets, is kind of the nuclear policy. So you can talk a little bit about how DIA played a role in some of the bigger conversations that we had during the Cold War of, like, what is our nuclear stance? How are we actually going to fight World War III if it ended up happening?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at your museum with my son last week. Fantastic. It was a great experience. And I was watching one of your videos, and it talked about the Cold War specifically and how huge it was in terms of literally essentially saving. We were literally at the point of destroying the entire world. And all of the intelligence and the efforts that went behind actually keeping us out of war, keeping us at parity with the Soviets, was enormous. It was by far and large the largest part of DIA's effort during the entire Cold War was dedicated to the Soviet Union, even though, for instance, in our last discussion, we spoke so much about kind of the periphery operation. And operations include explosives and their shooting and things like that. By and large, for the actual Soviet effort in the Cold War, of course, we're not talking about actual explosions. We're trying to prevent actually going to war with them. And that included a lot more effort than I think most people may realize. And nuclear doctrine is certainly one of them. When the Soviet Union first got nuclear weapons, we had virtually no collection on the Soviet Union to be able to actually keep track of what they were doing and how well they were doing, how they were advancing. It's interesting, the last time we discussed the missile and bomber gap and during the 1950s and early 60s, and here's a period where we have absolutely no clue how many bombers they have. We have absolutely no clue how many missiles that they have. And that's largely because the lack of satellites. First satellite goes up, and you're really talking, again, early 60s, before you actually get enough satellites to be able to provide any real coverage. And what's more, not just coverage, you're not just talking about coverage, you're talking about capability as well, right? So coverage and capability on the Soviet Union, that's a sizable time thereafter. Humint is not timely necessarily. So you may have somebody in the Soviet Union, a really good spy, who is collecting information and providing it back to us, but sometimes that's a month, it's 2 months, whatever it is. The newspapers certainly aren't going to help us. The Soviet newspapers certainly aren't going to help us except for propaganda. So for the early part of the Cold War, there's a real gap in terms of the Soviets' true ability to hit the United States with nuclear weapons. And of course, there's periods of time where we think the Soviets are actually have an advantage over us. And so our basic doctrine in nuclear policy in the early years of the Cold War, really until the late 1970s, becomes one of essentially mutually assured destruction, which is we have no warning capability to see when they're actually going to do anything. We have very little visibility over truly how many missiles that they have. And so we have to always be standing by, ready to be able to retaliate in full. And essentially the effect is we want to deter them, right? Because we don't know what they're doing, what their intent is, when they're going to actually do something. We're hoping to deter them and say, if you fire off a single nuclear weapon, then we're going to both sides launch everything and we're going to destroy each other's countries. Of course, the problem with that is how do you deal with contingencies? So if the Soviets launch a massive ground attack into Germany and use several tactical nuclear weapons, is that going to precipitate a full mutually assured destruction attack against them? Suppose the Soviets allow Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, as all these peripheral wars are happening, and they use a tactical nuclear weapon there, or Cuba decides to use, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, a nuclear weapon. These contingency things, or if the Soviet Union launches a few nuclear weapons at, for instance, Britain, all of these different things leads you to question, are we really going to destroy the entire world based on these early contingency type of operations that may not include large-scale use of nuclear weapons? And so, even as early as 1960, some theorists out there like Herman Kahn were already talking about you've got to break out of this. You've got to think about a way of getting outside the box and understanding that you can escalate in nuclear warfare just as you can in regular warfare. And he actually had 44 rungs of escalation. Now, the problem with Herman Kahn at that time is...
Several problems with Herman Kahn.
Of course, the funny thing is Herman Kahn is Dr. Strangelove in the movie. Is you have to have the intelligence to be able to do that.
Right.
So going back to that entire thing of, yeah, sure, we would love to be able to develop an escalatory policy, but we just it's very difficult if you don't have the intelligence and you don't have a clear picture of what the adversary's intent is to do that. And so it took quite a while to be able to get to that space. But by the mid-1970s, it becomes clear now we have more and more collection capability. We now have the ability to determine much more accurately how many missiles the Soviets have, what their capability is, such as their circular error of probability, which is to say, early in the Cold War, the Soviets thought that they would be lucky to be able to even hit within 20 miles of a target in the United States. So they're looking at even being able to get close enough to hit a city, let alone hitting a reinforced, hardened silo
right.
with the precision necessary to be able to knock it out. So in the 1970s, DIA starts developing and getting the capability to actually have a much finer perspective on Soviet capabilities, where they're putting their missiles, how good they are, what their command and control situation is, all the way to their underground facilities so that, are they trying to survive a nuclear war? We have a much better perspective by the 1970s. And so when Carter comes into office and he says we really need to rethink our entire nuclear policy, DIA is putting together reports and going and saying all of what I just said. We have a lot more information to be able to go on right now, and we can develop targeting packages that allow for escalation where we don't have to rely on a full wide-scale nuclear war. We can hit their industrial sites. We can hit, one of the things I find is interesting, in the early 1970s, the Soviet leaders started building a number of really hardened command and control bunkers outside of Moscow. And we were putting together analysis at that time saying really, it looks like Soviet leaders have the intent of actually establishing a war-winning policy with nuclear war. They think that they can win. And if the leaders can go find themselves in a bunker somewhere, this is kind of the humor of Dr. Strangelove right. at the end of the mineshaft gap, right? But this is really happening. They are actually developing these hardened underground facilities. And if they think they can win a war, well, that changes the mindset that they have and that we have to have in relationship to that. So things like targeting underground facilities becomes a big deal. In fact, when we put together one of the studies on this, the National Security Council came to DI and said, we would really like you to develop a little bit more reporting and put out a finished product on their underground facilities and their mindset of wanting to win a war. And what we want to be able to do is go kind of public with that. So we completed a report. We gave it to them. They actually were disseminating information at the unclassified level that they knew would get to the Soviets that would clearly indicate to the Soviets, like, your hardened facilities outside of Moscow are not going to be free from targeting. In fact, they're probably going to be among the first targets, so that we could start setting that line in the sand in terms of you can't win a nuclear war with us. But then internally saying we are also not going to go immediately full guns and destroy the entire world. We're going to develop specific target packages that say we can limit, hopefully, an initial nuclear exchange and not destroy the world.
Well, I think students of diplomatic history may have read, you know, some of the titans in the field and understand how nuclear strategy shifted from massive retaliation during Eisenhower to flexible response to kind of more counterforce strategy, where you're just trying to hit their silos and their nuclear capability, and not realize, or at least think that it had to do with personalities of new presidents and new people in charge, and not realize the engine behind a lot of this was actually how much we knew and how much we understood about the Soviet threat versus, oh, Kennedy just thought differently than Eisenhower, you know, all that. That certainly plays a role, but as you're telling us now, intelligence and the ability to understand the threat was a key driver in these strategic changes.
Right. If the first time you know that you're about ready to get hit with nuclear missiles is just before is when they've already crossed the poles, mm-hmm. and you've got about 10 minutes left and it's a full nuclear exchange, clearly your intelligence is not working. And so you have to prepare. You have to prepare for that being the major contingency. Is we have to prepare our nuclear doctrine that the President of the United States is going to have 10 minutes or less to make a decision to retaliate, and we have to expect that they're going to use their full nuclear force against us. That's the early period. Then, like I said, as we started getting more intelligence, you start seeing, okay, well, we have visibility into some of their command and control. We have some visibility into where their missiles are and how much time that we have. We also get more visibility into their doctrine so that we find out their doctrine is not necessarily initially mutually assured destruction. In fact, the Soviets had a more flexible perspective on nuclear weapons well before we did. But you don't find that stuff out if you don't dedicate intelligence to it, and technology also. So it's not just the intelligence, but the technology that goes against intelligence that allows you to start getting that capability. So U-2, you know, we lose the U-2 over Russia, and that was, you know, a real principal form of collection for us in the early years of the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Well, you can only do limited flights. You know, it's not full coverage. Limited satellite coverage, but now all of a sudden when you start talking about us putting more and more satellites mm-hmm. up with more and more capability that that can do more and more things, then whereas when we had the missile gap where we didn't even know, the Air Force perspective then is, well, because we can't see the entire country, we have to assume there's missiles everywhere.
Right.
That's one way of actually looking at it, because if you don't have the coverage, and if you hear the Soviets saying, you know, comrades, we are building like large numbers of nuclear weapons to destroy your country, and you go, okay, well, we can't see their country, so we're going to go on that. It's not till later that you're actually able to go do more research, do more analysis, and find that those missiles just don't exist. So it's the technology driven also by need. Of intelligence. And then, so by 1983, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger develops a whole new nuclear policy, flexible response, and that's really a large part because DIA was the lead for nuclear targeting during this entire period of time throughout the 70s and 80s, DI is the one providing all the targeting information and such. So DI is really, really becomes instrumental in developing and assisting in changing what, let's face it, a doctrine that really, if there had been a nuclear war, you know, really would have meant essentially the end of the world, or certainly a large part of it, to something far, far different. And it kind of is interesting as time goes on, too. Even something like where all the debris goes up in the atmosphere. And
nuclear
the,
winter.
Nuclear winter. Yeah. So nuclear winter, the DOD actually put out an agreement that, or a statement that, that the Department of Defense agrees that if there's a nuclear war, at the scale and size that we're talking about, there's going to be a nuclear winter. And that was a really big deal to come out and say, like, okay, even if you live in Africa or whatever, the change in the atmosphere, the change in the entire global system, if there's a major nuclear war, is essentially going to kill everything.
Right.
Well, the policy of appreciating and agreeing with the fact there's going to be a nuclear winter was based on on DIA development of completion of analysis on Soviet capabilities. And we said, if the Soviets begin a nuclear war, they're going to fire, you know, 1,500 nuclear weapons at us. By this time, they're probably going to be MIRVed, so you're talking about even a much larger number of actually nuclear warheads hitting us, so there's going to be this nuclear winter. That really drove a lot of the push for the INF Treaty, which I'll talk about here in a few minutes, but was enormous in reducing not only numbers of nuclear weapons, but also kind of the policies behind the, how they would be used as well. So DIA's nuclear policy assistance in that with intelligence proved to be really important. And this is the type of stuff that in history goes by the wayside because it didn't involve people dying. Well, actually, I will tell you there were people dying. There were spies dying.
Right.
There were you know, it was really a nasty period. But it doesn't fit in movies very well and those types of things because you're not talking about, you know, tanks being moved from here to here or whatever. But when you think about the actual impact of in global history of what had happened had this analysis not been there, what had happened if the decision maker made a wrong decision based on wrong information because their intelligence wasn't there, it's really a pretty big deal.
Well, let me shift to something tangential to this, but still important, because what many people may not think about is the impact of not military technology but civilian technology on things like the nuclear arms race. And the DIA provided a vital role in intelligence support looking at tech transfer. You know, the Soviets were behind the United States and the West and a lot of what we consider commercial technologies, a lot of mainstream technologies. I mean, computer technology is a great example of this. You know, the 1980s, it was night and day. They were decades behind. But that doesn't mean the Soviets can't get their hands on it. They meant to be developing themselves. And for making an adequate or accurate assessment of Soviet capabilities, you need to know what's going back and forth. And can you talk a little bit about the importance of that and then somehow where the DIA's played a role in this?
Right. You know, one real unique thing about the United States is so much of our military capability is actually designed by private industry, of course. And we take a lot of the upgrades and things that we get from private industry. We take commercial off-the-shelf materials, and we translate that into improvements for military capability. And so when our adversaries look at us, they're not just looking at our military. Of course, they're looking at our private sector in terms of commercial off-the-shelf stuff, in terms of the military capabilities to be being developed by our defense firms. It's no strange thing that the MiG-29 looks, you know, almost identical to the F-14 and the F-15. And as we've made advances, you see those advances clearly happening with our adversaries as well. And a large part of that is the level of effort that, in this case, the Soviet Union put toward stealing not just our military secrets, but also stealing commercial secrets and trying to procure through all sorts of different legitimate and illegitimate methods technology that they couldn't develop themselves.
You know, you procure straight up buying it from companies, right? This isn't sneaky spy stuff. This is saying, hey, we've got a lot of money, we want to buy stuff. And in some cases, it wasn't like, let's buy a tank from General Atomics, right? Let's get an M1 as it rolls off. These are things like ball bearings. And if you saw them on a paper and you didn't really understand what was going on, you'd be like, yeah, sure, who cares if the Soviets can buy ball bearings? What can you do with ball bearings?
Yeah, the ball bearing story is actually pretty funny because it's one of those situations. The intelligence community gets hit a lot when we're wrong, but the ball bearing situation in the 60s and 70s is actually a funny story because it's what happens sometimes if you don't listen to intelligence. So in the 1960s, the Soviet Union tried to procure what was called the Centaline B grinder, which produced really high precision ball bearings. I mean, these are ball bearings that are so perfect, minuscule ball bearings that are so perfect that they use them for really advanced optical. That they're only used for advanced optical lenses and really, really super advanced military capabilities like precision guidance systems. So in 1960, the Soviets tried to openly procure a bunch of ball bearing technology, a bunch of these machines. And incidentally, the only corporation in the world that could produce this stuff was in the United States at the advanced level that was needed. Well, DOD vigorously opposed this. So this is right before DIA was established in 1960, but DOD vigorously opposed it. A Senate subcommittee looked at it and said, yeah, this is bad news. We do not want to sell them this because what are you going to use them for except advancing your military capability substantially? Well, several years go by, there's changes in policy toward the Soviet Union where we're trying to de-escalate, trying to make detente efforts, smooth things out, and the issue comes up again. The Soviet Union once again makes an effort to go buy a whole bunch of these Centaline B machines. Well, by this point in time, now DIA was established, and DIA actually led a lot of the efforts to try to mitigate the sale of these type of advanced commercial capabilities to the Soviet Union and other nations that wanted capabilities that would hurt us. And we warned the National Security Council and, quite frankly, anybody who would listen about the danger of selling these minuscule ball bearings to the Soviet Union. We said it has the potential of actually rendering all of our missiles and our silos vulnerable because it will take, again, like I mentioned earlier, that circular error of probability, and it will minimize it to such a degree that our hardened silos now become vulnerable. So now you don't have to, as the Soviet Union, try and drop a 15-megaton bomb that is so big that it's going to destroy everything around, but still is not accurate enough that it might even destroy the silo. But now, with even far more tactical-type nuclear weapons, are so accurate that they're able to almost hit our silos and destroy them. So we said, really, this is a bad idea. Well, the Soviets came back and they said, well, you know, this is really just for trucks. We want to use these ball bearings for the production of commercial vehicles. Well, I mean, look, a Russian car. You know, this is like getting a Stradaline whatever violin for your kid, an $80,000 violin for your kid to learn how to use a violin, that you're going to use a precision ball bearing from one of these machines for a truck, right? It's ridiculous. But such was the political impetus at the time to try and improve relations with the Soviet Union that we ended up selling them 164 of these machines for a cost of $20 million, right? $20 million. Okay, well, $20 million, all right. 1976, so that was in 1972 we made the sale. 1976, DIA is going before House Subcommittee, and by that time we're already telling them that we see some significant improvements in the Russian ability to improve their targeting capability across the board. So not just with nuclear weapons, but across the board in their weapon systems. And we started really seeing it happen in their SS-18s. Now, SS-18 is kind of a unique weapon. It's a transition from a single warhead, kind of sluggish, large right. missile, to a very advanced, long-range missile system that actually has 10 warheads on it. It can either carry 10 warheads or it can carry a large, like, 25-megaton nuclear bomb. 25 megatons will destroy New York, I mean, the entire city of New York by itself.
And most of New Jersey and a lot
and
of
most of, and a lot of everything else around there, right? And we saw that these SS-18s were getting more and more accurate. And this was all coming, and we knew this, right? So this was all coming out of the fact that we had sold them this minuscule ball bearing technology, that they were improving their guidance systems. Well, now we understood, the United States government understood, that it really did render a lot of our nuclear forces vulnerable to a first strike. So what did we do? Well, we had to develop a whole new weapon system that was able to maneuver and move in such a way that SS-18s, that the Soviet Union wouldn't be able to capture the large part of our ICBM forces in their silos. So we said, well, MX missile, let's do that. The Peacekeeper, MX, yeah. Right? The LGM 118A Peacekeeper, which came with a total budgeted cost. In the end, we spent about $20 billion on the MX missile system. So for, you know, you balance that out. For $20 million in sales, we ended up ultimately paying $20 billion as a result of that sale. And those types of things are really, really dangerous. And that's a large part of the reason that you have, you know, DIA and other organizations out there who are doing this type of analysis. You always wonder, where does all the Intel money go? What is it really being used for? Well, of course, you don't know anything about a Centerline B grinder and its impact on precision right. guidance capabilities to destroy and render your entire silo force, you know, vulnerable, unless you're actually having the experts out there go and do this type of analysis.
Well, even more, I mean, maybe you don't have to be an expert to see how incredibly well-manufactured ball bearings have particular purposes. But even look at something even more benign as air traffic control systems, right? To where you're like, what could it hurt to help them make sure their civilian air traffic is safer? You know, we have the greatest air traffic control in the world. We should share this with them so that they don't have their planes running into each other. What could go wrong? Well, what could go wrong?
It's air traffic control. It's truly benign, truly yeah. benign. Nobody could ever use an advanced air traffic control system for anything negative. This was one of those situations that luckily we were on the other side of this, where policymakers actually did listen, and thank goodness most time policymakers, you know, try to do their best to make the right decisions. In 1972, the Soviets tried to actually purchase again here another whole set of commercial off-the-shelf technology in Western air traffic control system, really advanced Western air traffic control systems. The real reason they wanted to do this again was not, you know, just like the ball bearings to build, you know, better trucks in this case, or to improve the traffic control station at Moscow's international airport. It was to make advanced, really big advancements in their surface-to-air missile capability and their air defense throughout their country. And this technology would greatly improve their air defense capabilities, the command and control, the ability to be able to provide information about incoming aircraft and threats.
Yeah, I mean, basically, a civilian air traffic, like at Dulles or at Reagan Airport, is essentially in the air with an AWACS system. If you've seen the planes with the big domes, that's essentially a flying air traffic control system. That's kind of the foundation of our control of the skies, and that's kind of what you're seeing the Russians going after in this case.
Right, and it's one of those instances of commercial off-the-shelf technology, again, that is used, that has weapons applications that we do the same thing. We look at our own commercial off-the-shelf technology and say, how can we use it? Soviets were doing that too. Well, we found we were leading a large science and technology effort at the time directed at the Soviets, again, trying to mitigate these types of things. And when we saw the effort to try and sell this material to the Soviet Union, we went to the Department of Justice and we said, hey, we're really concerned about the sale of this material to the Soviet Union. We think there's really big military applications in this. And the Department of Justice began an investigation to see what was the actual, not just from the Soviet perspective, which we were providing them, but from the U.S. perspective, whether or not the commercial vendors and such knew about what was happening. It turns out that it was going to be an illicit sale. And as a result of teeing up this investigation, the corporation was not only turned down in terms of the sale, but ended up having to pay the single largest imposed fine up in the United States to that time on a U.S. export control issue. And it was a lot of money then. Front page newspaper. And we were able to stop that sale. Now, because that sale went through, we started looking and saying, where else might the Soviet Union start looking to do this? And one of our allies had a corporation, too, working with the Soviet Union to try to sell that technology to the Soviets. So we developed a relationship with our partner nation. We let them know about the dangers of what would happen if the Soviets got that technology. And we were able to, there as well, mitigate the sale of that. An important part of this, too, is you start learning the dangers of this from a policy perspective, you know, and they completely changed policy as a result of this successful effort to break down that sale. Well, As we were looking at that, we were finding that the Soviets were also looking at other things as well. In this case, like telecommunications. Simple telecommunications. Well, again, like, okay, well, phones and networks and all that, that's commercial. Not a big deal. But here, too, the Soviets were looking to rapidly bolster and get up to speed against the West by buying Western technology for telecommunication systems so that they could improve their command and control, and principally for nuclear command and control capability. And so here's another situation where, in looking at that, we worked very hard. We were able to determine what they were doing, and we helped to mitigate that sale. And as a result of the telecommunications failed effort, the U.S. government developed the first set of comprehensive agreements between Western nations on the level of technology that could be sold to the Soviet Union across the board, across a whole range of different fields, you know, aviation, right, command and control technology, and so on. And so this turned out to be, during this time, a real success story in the fact that we were using intelligence in a way that was enabling policy. And again, remember, that's what almost all is for. Intelligence, you know, you hope that you never have to go to war. What intelligence is first and foremost supposed to be to do is to tee up policymakers, keep them informed of what's happening to avoid war so that, right, you can get them ahead of the issues that are happening. And here's a case where we were limiting the technology that was being provided to our adversaries that certainly would have improved their capabilities, again, just like the ball bearings. And we were able to get ahead of that and actually change policy as a result. And throughout the 1980s, then, we were able to mitigate a large number of technology transfers to the Soviet Union.
What I think is interesting is that every time the Soviets are trying to buy a new Western technology, they're telling us what they're lagging behind technologically. Essentially, they're letting us know where they're having trouble with their own in-house science and technology efforts. You know, if they have to buy it overseas, it means they know they can't produce it in-house. So not only are you stopping them from getting better, but they're providing you with great information about where they are at on a particular technology as well.
Right. It can either be a trigger, like, wow, we thought that they were far more advanced than this, or it can be confirming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we already knew that they were really far behind, and now this just goes to demonstrate that. That's absolutely, absolutely right.
We'll have more with Greg in a moment, but have you ever wondered if you might be a target of a ransomware attack? How vulnerable are you? It's easy to get freaked out by what we see on TV every day, especially when ransomware attacks are happening around the world. We just can't unplug and hope the bad guys go away. Too much of our lives are online. Would it be helpful if there were knowledgeable people who are willing to tell us what is and isn't possible? Well, the new podcast Hackable from McAfee is out to show you. Every week, Jeff Siskin and his team of cybersecurity experts conduct in-depth experiments to uncover the truth about cyber attacks. This week, Jeff lets a hacker hijack his computer and haul all of its data, sensitive documents, and even photos of an adorable puppy for ransom. Through some unsettling feelings, encryptions, and bitcoins, they go through the process of what happens to a victim of a ransomware attack. Sounds a little crazy, but it's all in the name of science. Look, as I've told you before, I know SpyCast audience is not your normal podcast audience. It's safe to say that many of you know a whole lot about this subject. But what's cool about this podcast is that it does a pretty great job working the space between being accessible to novices with little information in the field and still providing solid information for those, let's say, more well-versed in the subject. This is information that comes straight from McAfee's experts, empowering people with specific things they can do to make their digital lives more secure. Good for your grandmothers and your neighbor who works for NSA. So, how worried should we be about the threat of a possible ransomware attack? Listen to Hackable, now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more.
As we move into the 70s and the 80s, it goes from figuring out what they're building to trying to actually decrease some of these weapons systems. You talked about INF, we'll get to that in a second, but starting in the early 1970s with like START and the SALT talks and START later on, things, you know, ABM treaties and NPT and all these wonderful acronyms that focus on arms control and then later arms reduction, actual disarmament talks. The only way those work is if we know everyone is doing what they're supposed to. I mean, verification, right? That's that magic word people throw around. So how much has DIA played a role in ensuring the verification of some of these arms control treaties?
The first part of ensuring that they're actually living up to the verifications is actually participating in the treaties themselves. And DI has been a really key player in arms control treaties worldwide, but of course with the Soviet Union during the entire Cold War. You know, so we were involved with the 1963 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the ABM Treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, which was a really, really big deal. And then as you move into the 1980s, yeah, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances. So you talk about all these things that you, first of all, DI is the agent is the agency, or at least a principal agency in many of these negotiations, going to the table, actually helping to provide, again, policymakers with the intelligence necessary so that they don't make mistakes at the table like they did with the minuscule ball bearing, where it just sounds like a simple procedural, you know, discussion of can we buy some machines? Well, sure. If you have the right people at the table who know what's going on, then you're able to have that person whisper in your principal's ear and say, that's a really bad idea. You don't
want
to do
that. These are insanely complicated conversations, right? People talk about throw weight and, you know, time on target and MIRVs and all these that... These are diplomats. Maybe they're not physicists. Maybe they haven't been studying nuclear weapons for their entire careers. And then you can provide them with the backing of a DI analyst who has been studying this their entire career.
So, yeah, like the backfire bomber. This is a fairly late, fairly advanced Soviet bomber that they built. And the big question was it intercontinental? Was it a long-range bomber? Was it only a coastal bomber? And being able to have experts sit at the table and be able to provide that information to be able to say we need to be wary when they say they only have, you know, 500 bombers, that, you know, 500 long-range bombers. Well, does that include the backfires or not? And are they truly – do they truly have that capability? You have to have that. You have to have that capability. You have to be able to say, we know that the SS-18 actually carries 10 warheads, so don't come to the table and say that we only have a certain number of platforms, and if you put one missile on one warhead on each one, well, we don't have that many. Well, yeah, you multiply it times 10 because that's how many. So you have to have that level of expertise. So there's that foundational intelligence that I go back to time and time again, which is the people who every day just sit and do analysis and maintain visibility on the adversaries, on what their military capabilities are, what they're doing, how many they have. That isn't seen every day. It's the type of thing that you hope that you never go to war, but when you do go to war, the information's there. It's also the information for treaties and such that you go to the senior policymakers and you already have a baseline understanding and foundation of your adversary's capability so that you don't make those mistakes at the table. And then when something does happen, because you were at the table, it's much easier for you to be able to call out the adversary and say, you know, I think that you're breaking the rules, or at least inform policymakers so that they can make, again, informed decisions about what's happening. So, for instance, on the Biological Weapons Convention, we sit through that, and it's very clear both sides are supposed to eliminate all of their biological weapons. In fact, here in the United States, when Nixon canceled our program, he went on television and he said, we're eliminating everything. Our largest biological weapons capability was up in Frederick, Maryland at Fort Detrick. And essentially, everybody there lost their jobs. You know, it was a very public, very big deal. It was in the United States, it was well known that we were doing, and it was very visible. In the Soviet Union, they signed the document, but they never really ever intended to live up to it. They maintained developing some of the most capable weaponized biological weapons in history. I mean, this is just terrible stuff. I mean,
yeah, we're talking smallpox, anthrax, and Ebola. Well, you know,
and going developing anthrax, for instance, that survives any sort of vaccine.
Right.
So it's not just that you're developing, you know, an anthrax to kill everybody. You're making sure that your adversary can't even give anybody vaccines to try to stop it. So in April of 1979, long before April 1979, we had been watching the Soviets and their weaponized capabilities on biological weapons. Of course, continuously warning policymakers, we don't think that they're living up to their agreements. On April 2nd, 1979, suddenly there's a big outbreak of anthrax in Sverdlovsk in Russia. And the Soviets say it's just improper meat handling. There's some meat that got bad. We put it out in the stores, and a bunch of people are dying from it. You know, nothing to see here. Nothing right. to see here. And in fact, a Soviet delegation categorically stated, you know, this incident has no bearing on the question of compliance by the USSR of the Convention on the Prohibition of Bacteriological Toxin Weapons. You know, categorically, nothing to do with this, right? And all these people are dying. Well, we, of course, had been watching Sverdlovsk for a while. We already had our concerns. When this happened, it started breaking the number of deaths, the widespread nature of this. By the way, when you drew a line of the wind pattern and then you started getting information about where the anthrax cases were happening, you were able to see a clear, almost straight line on wind pattern to see, like, okay, well, if they're in stores, then why aren't there people on the southeast side of Sverdlovsk getting it? Why aren't people on the northwest side getting it? Why isn't only people in the northeast side of
Sverdlovsk downwind
are getting this, right? So we start hearing first rumors about a large outbreak. And then we have a number of Soviet emigres going to Europe. And when they come to Europe, they start talking about this. A number of Soviet Jews who went to Israel came and started talking about it as well. And then more and more information starts coming out. Well, right away, I mean, right when we saw this come out, we immediately provided information warning that the outbreak was likely nothing to do with meat packing or anything like that. It simply had none of the signatures that would indicate that it was a traditional outbreak of anthrax in a community where there's a lot of sheep or livestock or whatever. It just simply didn't have those signatures. So we immediately started putting together products, a defense intelligence note, a weekly intelligence summary to senior policymakers, keeping them informed of what was happening. We put out a number of intelligence reports, actual raw intelligence reports about what was happening. And we maintained information on this in the early 80s and well through. And what that really did for us, too, is it triggered us to reinvigorate efforts to try to look at and get our arms around what was happening, because this wasn't something where it was a third-hand source, you know, where somebody comes to Europe and it's my uncle's brother's third right. cousin nephew's daughter said that she saw a vial that looked like biological weapons being produced somewhere. No, this was a clear case where all of the indicators and all the information coming out suggested that this was something more than just a standard anthrax breakout. So each time that we were able to go to the table then with the Soviets, the U.S. government was able to go to the table with the Soviets and talk about arms control and verification and are you actually living up to it. This is one of those areas, again, where we're able to go to the Soviets and say, it's very clear that you're not living up to your agreements. Now, policymakers are the ones that make the decision, so what they choose to do with that information is ultimately theirs, but they were kept well informed. So then 1991 comes around, Soviet Union collapses, and in 1992, a colonel from the former Soviet Union, Colonel Kanat Alibekov, I'm not a Soviet speaker, Alibekov, anyway, he comes here and
Ken Alibek.
Yes,
yeah.
Ken Alibek, yes, comes here and begins telling the intelligence community and DIA exactly about what was happening. And he had been the deputy director of their Bioperpriate, which was the organization that developed and actually, you know, put out biological weapons. And he very clearly stated everything that we had said had been accurate and even expanded on the number of different terrible things that the Soviets had been doing in terms of biological weapons, but essentially confirming the DIA's concerns. More than 100 people ultimately had died from that anthrax outbreak. And it's interesting that one of the key people in the Soviet Union who helped cover up that accident was actually Boris Yeltsin, who was a local Communist Party official at the time and did everything he could. And so when, you know, later on when we're talking to Boris Yeltsin in arms control and everything, here's the person who had worked so hard to try to cover it up then, coming out later and still saying, "Oh, you know, we have nothing to do with
right.
it. We have no biological or chemical weapons," but we had already come to terms with the fact that we were accurate on that.
Well, Ken Alibek wrote a fascinating book called Biohazard. That basically, if you want to sleep well at night, don't read it. But it's certainly the bird, you know, first-person account.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book.
Well, and what was interesting about it was the Soviet response to all this was, well, the Americans publicly said that they weren't doing it anymore, but we just assumed they were cheating anyway. Yeah. So if they were going to cheat, we were going to cheat. And it's a wonderful mirror imaging there of, well, wonderful from hindsight and not getting killed by anthrax, mirror imaging that the Soviets are like, well, of course they're cheating. That's what we would do, and that's what we're going to do. So they assumed, and they kind of self-fulfilling prophecy was their response to that.
And the other thing is there were so many instances where the Soviets were cheating and where we were actually catching them that type of logic, you know, working against us would have worked had they caught us cheating. You know, if you could actually come to the table and say, okay, all right, look, you caught us with this anthrax thing, but you know what? We caught you, you know, actually saying that you had a missile that was only supposed to go, you know, 800 miles, and we caught you in a test that says it was going, you know, 3,000 miles, so therefore you've broken that. We caught them so many times. Another example of them where we were able to catch them in this and be able to, again, continue letting policymakers know about the concerns of the Soviets cheating on their arms control was the Cosmos 954. This was a RORSAT satellite. It's a radar ocean reconnaissance satellite that the Soviet Union put up in early 1977, and it immediately was off track when it launched. It started going out of orbit, and we had found out that it was actually a nuclear satellite, which was breaking the rules at the time. You're not supposed to put satellites into space that carry 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, as well as plutonium, cesium, strontium, all sorts of other fun stuff that, by the way, if this thing ever crash lands, it has the potential to cause a real nuclear type of disaster. Some satellites crash, right? So that's why we don't put anthrax in them either, right? And so they had put up this nuclear satellite, and it immediately went out of orbit. And in January of 1978, it crashed in Canada. And now, thank goodness, it happened in northern Canada. It had a 15,000 square mile debris path. Left debris all over the place. DIA, in working with the Canadians and also bringing another Department of Defense efforts, worked with the Canadians in an operation called Operation Morning Light. In -60 degree weather, DIA analysts as well as others in the intelligence community and the Canadians went up. We used a C-141, a KC-135 aircraft. We used U-2s to photograph the area and try and find out what was going on. We were able to actually identify hundreds of pieces of the satellite. Well, of course, now you can actually run tests on them. You don't really need to run a lot of tests to find out how radioactive these pieces are, but you're able to do that. But then also what you're able to do is you're able to go back and essentially help re-engineer and rebuild their satellite. And that, too, helps you say, where are they at? What agreements are they breaking? What capabilities do they have? And we actually used that. We painted a graphic representation of this that we put out in one of our unclassified books that we might get to in a few minutes called Soviet Military Power, where we were able to then show not just our senior policymakers what the Soviets were doing, but the entire world what they were doing. And they did it again and again and again. So when we went to the arms control table so many times, one of the great things is DIA was able to help ensure that our senior policymakers knew that when the Soviet Union signed an agreement and said, we're going to live up to it, and here's the terms of agreements and everything, they always had to take it with a grain of salt. They had to get everything in writing down to specific details because the Soviets were going to try to find any means or measures necessary to be able to improve their capability to get an advantage over us.
Right. Well, you did hint at our nice segue to the next topic. I remember actually when I was a kid growing up, I stumbled onto what looked like a very cool, like thick magazine at my friend's house, whose father worked for a particular agency. Even if he had any, may have had this anyway, but it was neat and it had a bunch of cool, look like paintings of fighter planes and submarines and ships. And I was old enough at the time to kind of understand what was going on. It was the Soviet Military Power 1988 book, which I still own today. You know, back from when it came out in 1988, it's a little rougher than it should be because I read it one too many times. But this, I've come to find out there was one basically every year. And so between then and now, I've been collecting as many of them as I possibly can. And these always
kind of made me wonder, like, are we giving away too much information here? Like, this is telling everybody what we know. But there's a really cool story about how DIA was able to kind of walk that thin line between showing the world what we knew without really giving away the sources and methods, right? Kind of the fancy, the terms we always throw around and what needs to be protected, but at the same time saying, hey, we know what this stuff does.
Right. Yeah, Soviet military power is great, and it goes to a theme that we kind of talked about the last time as well, which is DIA had a really tough beginning. We didn't have a nice start in 1961. It took a while for us to develop our capabilities. During the 60s, we were really looked down upon. During the 70s, we start really improving our capabilities in terms of collection, the number of missions that we have to take over for the intelligence community, the number of assets that we're able to start utilizing, the number of analysts. Everything in the 1970s starts to improve, so that when you talk about by the late 1970s, DIA is really on the ball in terms of understanding our adversaries, particularly, again, the Soviet Union. And in the late 1970s, we were seeing an enormous escalation of capability in Soviet military forces. They were building, you know, instead of one class of new submarine, they were building three new classes of submarines. Instead of one new fighter, they were developing four new fighter systems, and then they were procuring large numbers of them. And the sheer volume of Soviet military capability that was coming to fruition in the late 1970s had us really, really concerned. So we developed a very highly classified briefing that we took around, and we just briefed everybody who we could brief who was cleared for this about what was happening. And it stunned a lot of people because, you know, detente in the 1970s, early 1970s, things were supposed to be going well, and here we have the Soviet Union, who is clearly developing far more advanced capabilities. And again, even like I said earlier, doing things that suggested, information that we had suggested, they actually were thinking about how they could actually win a nuclear war. So we were doing this really super classified briefing, taking it all around. It was really lauded by everybody. And we go and we brief a number of senators. And when we're done briefing, Senator Ted Kennedy pulls our director aside, and he says, look, you've got to find a way to be able to provide this information to the American public and to a much wider audience, because people just aren't getting how bad this is. It's one thing to tell us at a classified level what's happening, but then we've got to go back to our taxpayers and try and sell them on the fact that we're going to increase defense spending substantially, which of course actually happens in the 1980s. So you've got to find a way to get this information out there. Well, at roughly the same time, we also briefed some NATO partners, and the minister, one of the senior ministers in NATO, said essentially the same thing: like, you're telling us as NATO, we need to increase and bolster our capabilities. We have our own taxpayers here who are not real enthusiastic about increasing defense spending, and they're not seeing the type of information that you and I are seeing to say we really need to bolster it. So we have these two our partners, and then a senior senator telling us we have to really find a better way of providing the information. Casper Wein, we start taking that to ground, and then Casper Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, also comes in and says, we really need to escalate this. We need to get it out there, because it's that important if we're going to try to maintain pace and let the American people know and the world know what's happening. So we decided to write our first Soviet military power book. It came out in September of 1981. And the notion was to take nothing but classified information, true information, nothing fabricated, from good sources that we could actually validate, and to create an unclassified book that everybody could see. Well, what that means is you take out the sources and methods, right? That's the first thing in getting something declassified. A lot of the times, the information, it's not so much the information itself that's sensitive, it's how did you come to get it?
Right.
So it's sources and methods. So we eliminate the sources and methods, and we are able to then say, okay, now what are the things that are too sensitive? Like, we can't even touch those things. So you pull those out, and what you come up with is still a fairly substantive picture of the Soviet military capability. Okay, we can tell the American people that they have three new classes of submarines coming out. Okay, well, now you do graphics, and we really did a good job of trying to show the graphics, not only of the Soviet capabilities, but ours, and what our procurement spending plan was and what their procurement spending plan was, so that you could get that nature of just how bad it was. But there were some areas that we looked at that we said, we just can't show this we can't show the picture of the new backfire bomber, blackjack bomber, the new submarine, because we only have a couple pictures of it, and if we post the picture, it's going to reveal our source. Right. So, for instance, one of the things we have is we have a beautiful painting. Well, I just kind of gave it away, but we have a picture of a blackjack bomber, one of the advanced Soviet bombers at the time, state of the art, and in front of the aircraft are several generals, Soviet generals, standing in front of it. Well, if that picture got out, anybody in the Soviet military would be able to say, okay, what air base is that? Because you can see the background. And, oh, that looks like General Asimov. You know, what day was General Asimov at that field?
Right.
And by doing that now, you're going to reveal or potentially give away the person or the source who took that picture. So we said, how can we show this new capability, this new bomber that they're developing, but not reveal the source? And so one of the things that we did, we had been using painting for a long time in DIA. Whenever we might get a piece of information that says the Soviets are developing, you know, go back in time a little bit, the T-72 tank, and we don't have a picture of it, but the source can give us some information on it. He says, well, it's a little bigger than a little smaller than the T-64, a little bit more compact, a little bit more compressed turret. We have artists then who are painting.
It's like
those.
A sketch artist when you get, you know, someone gets robbed or sees a crime. You kind of explain.
Exactly, but doing it pretty, right?
Right.
So pretty paintings and everything. But we had painters whose entire job it was to do this. And so when we were asked to put together Soviet military power, we had a large number of people already essentially ready to go to be able to work against this. And now you take that picture of the blackjack bomber with the generals in front of it, and you create a whole different background. So instead of it being in the plains in central Siberia, suddenly you put it near a coast. And you change the angle on the aircraft a little bit. And, of course, you're not going to paint the generals there.
Right.
And now what you have is a near-perfect replica painting of a blackjack bomber that has no way of being able to identify to anybody where we got that information from. We put out the first series, the first book in 1981, and huge press corps was there, and it was a really big deal. It immediately hit the streets, and people were horrified by what they found and the advances that a lot of people didn't realize. Year went by, we weren't really thinking about doing another one, but then as the pressure came in to keep that up, congressional pressure from the Secretary of Defense's pressure, the public's pressure to say, that's something that we as a public have a right to know, we need to be seeing this, and then from a congressional and administration standpoint, being able to use it to be able to justify defense spending, we then put one edition out every year until the end of the Soviet Union. We did it in 8 different languages because one of the our partners wanted this as well. So you can find Soviet military power in Japanese, you can find it in Italian, you can find it in German and French, and you can find it in Russian. And one of the interesting things is the Russians took, we gave it to the Russians, brought it to the arms control agreement deals and said, well, look, here's Soviet military power. And so when you say that you're not doing this, well, here's actual pictures of it,
right.
And here's actual information associated with it. So the Soviets took this. Now, some of Soviet leadership was so in the blind about their own defense, their own military, because of classifications and stuff, that they used Soviet military power. Soviet leadership used Soviet military power to understand and appreciate their own military, right? So that became a principal source for the Soviets to actually be able to use. And the other thing is they saw that it was so useful and it was such a powerful tool that they put out their own Soviet military power, but it's the opposite. It's against us. It's called From Whence the Peace. That makes the United States look evil. So
right.
You find all sorts of pictures in there about the B-1 bomber and the MX missile and all of these things where it's the United States who's actually driving all of the military capability. Now, you're going to ignore, you're not going to have graphics in there that show that there's 10 Soviet aircraft being procured for every one of ours, but you will see that the United States is developing a really super advanced F-15 fighter jet. And so they actually mirrored
right.
what we were doing to put out something as well. And Soviet military power was such a success then that when the Soviet Union ended, we ended it because we didn't have a Soviet Union to go against anymore, but we have now reinitiated the series because of the nature of where we're at in the world right now. DIA just put out a Russian military power with the same general kind of look and feel as the Soviet military power, with the intent of being able to do the same thing that we did in the 1980s, which is to let people know that the threat still is there. It hasn't gone away. We are still at risk from powerful nations out there who have real advanced capabilities.
Well, those are limited runs, right? I mean, is there going to be a much broader publication moving forward? Because I think people probably want to try to get their hands on that.
We're not going to produce so when Soviet military power came out, there was one year we produced over 400,000 copies of it. I mean, some of these were at books. You could get them through a lot of different venues. It's online. You can get it through the public, the government printing service. We are not producing the large quantities of actual hard copies now because we just find that most people are more apt to use the internet and use it as a source there anyway. But it's an extremely useful product for people to be able, again, to get a grasp on the fact that we are still in a dangerous world. And so the notion that because there's not a Soviet Union, there isn't advanced capabilities out there that could threaten the United States is a dangerous thing.
So let's wrap this up by looking at I think a misconception that the entirety of the intelligence community missed the collapse of the Soviet Union. Not pointing any fingers at any certain agencies out there, but it's been conventional wisdom that we were caught completely surprised by the Soviet Union falling apart in 1991. You know, certainly no agency picked the day or the exact month, but DIA got closer than some. Talk a little bit about the ways that DIA was able to predict some of this collapse, and how close do you guys actually get?
Let me talk about the what we didn't get right, because that's first, because that I think is pretty easy. Even when I talk in a second about the things that we were able to provide senior policymakers to say that we think things are going really bad and that something significant is going to happen in the Soviet Union that may result in some really bad stuff, the real question in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, one of the really big issues was, will the hardliners allow the Soviet Union to collapse? And essentially, you know, you've had several years under Gorbachev. He's tried to change the economy and make it a little bit more flexible and all. Are the hardliners going to come in and actually say, Gorbachev, you're out. We're going to go back to hardline policies. We're going to introduce very strict measures inside the Soviet Union. We're going to get the protesters off the street, because by 1991, of course, there's protests all over the Soviet Union. Whether or not they're going to divert back to some of their hardline policies. That's the thing that DIA gets wrong, was the fact that we said we predicted that 1991 something significant, something very major was going to happen. Our assessment, though, was based on historic precedents where the Soviet Union had never allowed, had not really allowed even its partners to do anything. You remember Budapest and
56 and 67 and in 1980 in Poland. I mean, you're looking at all the crackdowns. Yeah,
right. And so we're looking at that, and we're saying it's unlikely that the Soviet Union is just going to roll over and die quietly. And of course, we were right insofar as the hardliners tried to do that. They tried a coup against Gorbachev, and the coup failed. So we weren't entirely wrong there. We expected something to happen. We just thought that the coup would probably, if there was a coup, it would probably be successful. But what we were right in is calling out the fact that the Soviet Union was veering toward a major issue or a major collapse or fall that was going to drive some sort of change. And that was as early as 1985. And so in 1985, shortly after Gorbachev comes to power, we begin a process of working with CIA to do a series of economic studies for Congress, unclassified. So these are actually unclassified assessments on the Soviet economy. And this goes into a whole bunch of different things. So we were looking at the gross national product. And in the mid-1980s, the gross national product of the Soviet Union was the worst that it had been since World War II. We looked at agricultural and industrial output, inflation, raw material costs, standard of living, commodity prices, consumer index, poverty, deficit spending, and then, of course, the guns versus butter debate of how much money was the Soviet Union putting into defense and how much were they putting into, you know, trying to keep people happy.
Right.
And the guns part of it was taking up such a significant part of the economy that it was causing a lot of civil unrest as well. So you had civil unrest increasing at a time that the economy was also going down, but the Soviets were, as I've talked about almost this entire time, trying to drastically increase defense spending. So in 1985, we began that series. In 1986, the second one, for instance, is called The Soviet Economy Under a New Soviet Leader. And we start talking about growth being less than 1%. And the difficulties and the struggles that Gorbachev was having in trying to stabilize the economy and have it grow at the same time that he was trying to essentially rebuild or completely redo the way that the Soviet Union had been doing economics since its inception. And so we tracked for a couple of years that all efforts were failing. And what's more, not only were they failing, things were getting significantly worse. So in 1989, for instance, the Soviets' own accounts were that 43 million people were living in poverty. And the natural thing there is, well, the Soviet Union lies about everything like that. We know that they lie about everything like that. So if they're saying 43 million living in poverty, it's actually substantially higher. We have all sorts of indexes and everything about how bad things are going. And, you know, you start having 87, 88. We start saying, unless drastic changes are made, unless they are able to rebound and recoup some of the areas where they're failing at, something really bad is going to happen. And we started tracking that more and more, so that by the time you get to 89, we're saying in the next couple of years, truly, if a major shift doesn't happen, the Soviet economy is going to collapse. Now, we didn't say the Soviet Union is going to collapse. That's, like I said, that issue of, well, the Soviet economy may collapse, but hardliners may be able to take over and at least, you know, keep a national identity. But we were saying at that period of time that we were looking at the fact that unless something dramatic, and I'm talking a wholesale change in the way that they were doing right. things, happens, that the Soviet economy is going to collapse. And that as a result of that collapse, you could not have a population who was as disgruntled as they were, who were starving. Though, by the way, the only economic indicator that remained stable during this period of time and actually improved was alcohol. So, you know, you can't have a population who's that disgruntled with the economy going down, with so much money being spent on defense, be able to get out of that and have an economy collapse without having a major crisis. So we predicted, kudos to the CIA and working with us on this, but the two we led the effort with CIA supporting, and so, you know, we were able to tell senior policymakers and warn well in advance that, you know, when you were looking at the early 1990s, we were predicting that senior policymakers were going to have to deal with some sort of genuine significant crisis in the Soviet Union. And of course that happened. We got the coup wrong. We thought the coup, like I said, would be successful, but we got the general principle of the fact that the Soviet Union was going to suffer something very significant. We got that call right.
You were rewarded for your prediction by dealing with debates in the United States about completely annihilating your budget and maybe even canceling DIA holistically. So I don't want to get too far into the post-Cold War era because I want to not kind of half-ass it. I want to save it for future times where we can specifically talk about different things. But I am interested in talking about just the direct period after the end of the Cold War and the debates. So, I mean, CIA went through this also. You got, like, Daniel Patrick Moynihan saying, we don't need one anymore. I mean, it was DIA within that same debate. Was the peace dividend, which everyone liked to throw around, focused on conventional military, you know, capabilities, hit the intelligence community incredibly hard. How much was DIA pulled down by the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, so there were debates about whether or not to just eliminate DIA altogether. I mean, DIA is an agency that was created, found, made its bread and butter on the defense threat principally of the Soviet Union, right? So we did military stuff all over the world, and there's all sorts of success stories about that. But ultimately, you know, a lot of even the contingency operations was a result of the Soviet Union and what they were doing abroad. And now the Soviet Union's gone, so everybody's going to go to bed at night and be happy, and there's going to be peace and happiness and love and joy, and we don't really need to have the Defense Intelligence Agency and or other agencies out there at nearly the rate of what they're doing right now. So there's going to be significant cuts. And so we managed to not get the axe, and there were enough people out there who realized, like, well, okay, so what does a post-Soviet Union look like? All these post-Soviet, you know, country, or all the breakup of the Soviet Union, what's going to happen in all of those areas? Drugs, you know, drugs haven't gone away. There are still some things out there. But we took enormous budget cuts, and we had to do some really significant internal reorganizations to rethink about what we were doing and aligning against what threats were still out there and so on. It was a very, very difficult time for the agency to go through. And, of course, without speaking too much, you know, about future things, of course, the interesting thing that happens during the 90s is that even though there's no Soviet Union, the United States deploys its military forces more than any decade other than 1940 before, you know, before the 1990s.
Right.
So, you know, you've got Provide Hope, Southern Watch, Restore Hope, Deny Flight, Provide Promise, Uphold Democracy, Joint Endeavor, Guardian Assistance, Guardian Retrieval, Joint Guard, Joint Forge, Shining Presence, Joint Guardian, Noble Anvil. You got all these operations in the 1990s where the U.S. is sending large military forces over, and the military intelligence requirements for all of those don't go away.
Right.
You know, you still have to know the adversary. You still have to know the health environment. You still need to know all of those things. So it was a bit of an irony that at the same time that we were facing so many budget cuts, our requirements actually increased, and that provided some real challenge for us.
Well, I mean, this is a dark period, right? The end of the Cold War and before the War on Terror begins is also the time when there's. I mean, I remember a lot of these names. You know, I remember chuckling at some of them, but I was in some of these operations, so I would get that. I mean, you know, these are massive. Restore Hope was huge. Joint Forge was the one that I was most heavily involved with in Bosnia. And this is a time. These are direct military operations. I mean, some of them are peacekeeping, peace enforcing. Some of them are, you know, Haitian relief, but it's still deploying the military to a place where the military brings guns because there may be some kind of a threat to their lives, and that's where DIA kind of earns its money.
It is. I talked about this a little bit last time too. It's you know, it's interesting that in the 19, although so much effort was dedicated against the Soviet Union, we were responsible. DIA is responsible for providing support anytime, anywhere the U.S. military may have to get involved in operations. Well, if you look at the tiers of countries that that the U.S. government was concerned about during the at the end of the Soviet Union and going through the early 90s and so on, you know, you were still concerned about Russia, you were still concerned about North Korea, and all of the big highlight countries that you would expect to see are there. Nobody has any sense that it's going to be Rwanda and Haiti and Somalia and Bosnia that are going to be the countries, Zaire, you know, that are going to be the countries that these operations are going to have to we're going to have to be involved in. And there's DIA ready to go at a moment's notice to support many of these. We had done substantial foundational intelligence on most of these areas, so that when the time came that we suddenly said, you know, Noble Anvil, Albania, what are we going to do about that? That we were ready to go for Albania, and we were ready to go for Somalia. And it the good thing about seeing something like this is the fact that the people should be heartened by the fact that we are able to go and be able to do. I mean, most of these are humanitarian operations, so we are doing really significant humanitarian efforts. But we have the ability to go and support operations wherever needed because of the fact that we are looking at things that most people think, I don't have any idea why you would ever want to look at some of these areas of the world. And there we are. We're able to provide that type of support.
We'd like to thank Hackable Podcast for McAfee. You can check out Hackable through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you find your favorite podcasts. So for more information on the role and history of the DIA, you can visit dia.mil. And also for if you're interested in the Russian military power, you can probably just Google it, but it's probably available through government printing office website. And that's more than likely where you're going to get it, the online version of that.
this is going to be something that we're going to do consistently. Sitting down with DIA, it won't always be Greg. Moving into the future, we'll bring some of the people actually currently working for DIA to talk about some specific topics. Whatever the topic, hot topic of the time is, we'll have a nice declassified conversation. I love watching active duty military types or analysts squirm when I ask a question, thinking about what they can and can't say. So I'll have a lot of fun doing that, and hopefully you'll get something out of it. So Greg, again, he was the chief historian for Defense Intelligence Agency. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us again here on SpyCast. We look forward to having further conversations with you.
Always appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.